two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Welcome back to In Recovery. I am so excited to be on mic for season 2. I'm Dr. Nzinga Harrison. I'm a physician, psychiatrist, addiction expert, and your host of this podcast. This season, we're going to do things a little bit differently. So, we started our show in the midst of a pandemic that we thought was going to be short-lived. And we've been in it now for over a year. And we're starting to see the sun come out of the clouds, we think, with vaccinations here and economies and communities opening up. But what I know is that that's not just like a Band-Aid, like, oh, all of a sudden the sun is out and everything is normal and let's get back onto our lives. We have been through so much trauma. And so we want to use this season to talk about our own collective recovery with a wider lens than just addiction. Like, yes, our recovery from an addiction perspective for sure, from a mental health perspective for sure, but as people, right? How do our relationships recover? How do our routines recover? How do we get back to feeling either like our pre-pandemic selves or what I think is probably more likely a new version of our post-pandemic selves? So when I think about the people that I've talked to over the last year and even myself, the changes that we've gone through, the people that we've lost, the relationships we've been cut off from, the priorities that I had before the pandemic that are totally different now, the racial unrest and awakening that the country is undergoing and how that changes us, what I know is that more than ever, we need to be connected to each other. We need to be listening to each other. We need to be holding each other up. I think maybe even more importantly than all of those, we need to be breaking down the stigma of saying, I need more than just myself to deal with whatever I'm dealing with. And so that's what we hope to do on this season of In Recovery, is bring on a lot of voices of a lot of people who have been through all of the a lot that all of us have been through and how they're currently recovering so that we can be learning from each other and holding each other up. And so you might hear me say the word trauma and think to yourself that you don't have the right to be included in that group because maybe you didn't lose your house. Maybe nobody that you know died of COVID or... And I'm crying because I put myself in this camp, which is that I have been very grateful that my kids did well in school and I have a job that I can work from home and I have a support system and I have means. Even with all of that, the trauma of the last year that you can hear in my tears is a real trauma. So though you may not have lost anyone from COVID, you have lost something because this last year took a lot from all of us. And it's being able to connect along a sense of loss and how we find our resilience without feeling guilt because maybe your loss doesn't look the same as somebody else's loss. And so you'll hear a collection of different stories on this episode. And I think even if the details of those experiences are different, the experience of those experiences will be something that you'll be able to connect to and that will hopefully be something that will help you, even as I feel like it's going to be helping me. So I'm going to be on mic with these folks. I do not promise not to cry every episode, even though maybe I'll set that as a goal. But the goal of season two is for us to be here for each other in ways that we need to be here for each other after every single one of us has gone through something we never thought we would go through over the last year, and how we make it through the upcoming year. Today, we're talking to Georgia Hardstark, one of the hosts from the highly acclaimed, well-loved true crime comedy podcast, My Favorite Murder. In her shared memoir with co-host Karen Kilgraff, Georgia shares that at 13 years old, she was already smoking meth. She spent her 14th birthday in rehab, and her illness relapsed after she was released, but then she stopped cold turkey. Georgia, welcome to In Recovery.
Whew, what an intro.
I know, right?
Thank you.
Like all of your business in the street right at the top of the show.
Let's do it. I'm an open book. It's so great to be here. I love the show.
Thank you.
What you're doing. It's a mitzvah, what you're doing.
Oh, thank you. I don't know that what I've been doing has ever been called a mitzvah, so I take that fully in.
Love it.
So I'm so glad you're here, because we want to use this season to like help people get to know the infinite number of pathways and experiences with addiction and recovery, and the infinite number of magic formulas that people are using to keep their feet on the ground. So that's what I'd like to spend some time getting to know of you today, if that's all right.
I would love that. And yeah, I'm an open book.
The intro said smoking meth by 13, which tells me a lot was going on before 13.
Oh, you're good.
So tell us who you were, what was going on in your life, just about Georgia.
Yeah. Well, I think the major thing was that I was a really sensitive, self-aware kid who was constantly thinking about how other people thought of me. Mm. And, you know, my parents divorced when I was 5, which is only rough. And I was a bit of an outcast, as we all probably were, in school. And so all I thought about and all I concentrated on was, am I cool enough? Do the popular girls like me? Do I seem stupid? It was this constant obsession almost about my persona. And, you know, I think there was some learning disability going on that was undiagnosed. Now I'm sure of it. Mm-hmm. There was some, you know, the reading recently about how ADHD isn't really diagnosed in girls as much, especially in the 80s and 90s. I am like, wow, I could have really used some of that help. So I think by the time I got 13, I was ready to like break out of that old Georgia and the girl who had been bullied, and ready for a new persona. And so this like drug punk tough scene was ideal for that, unfortunately. And I jumped in.
Yeah. How did you find the scene?
It's funny. I was just on a podcast called Turned Out a Punk. So this is fresh in my mind. I wanted to smoke pot. I wanted to smoke cigarettes. And I found the other girls, the two other girls at my junior high who were in the same boat. You know, we had similar backgrounds, single mothers, single fathers. And we were latchkey kids. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first time I bought a pack of cigarettes, we snuck into a like Coco's, and remember how they had the waiting rooms with cigarette machines?
Yes.
And you had to use coins. We snuck in down low, put coins in. So it was
but
just,
they were the loudest machines ever.
Oh my
like,
God.
Is there a way to
clink, clink? That's so true. So with those girls, I found the like, the other delinquents in my town, and they were just like me. And, you know, we somehow in Orange County in the 90s, I mean, I couldn't get like barely anything if you asked me now. Like, I don't know, right? How to get drugs. But then in the 90s, it was easy. It was I will say it was easy.
Mm-hmm. When I hear about adolescents who are, quote unquote, delinquent, then I think, what are they going through?
Ugh.
And so what was it about those girls, what they were going through, and kind of like the emotions and life experiences that they were having? Because more than cigarettes and more than delinquency tied you all together.
That's a very, very good point. Where I grew up in Irvine, it was WASP City. It was two parent homes, you know, stay at home mom. And it was, outside activities, and just they all had money. And I had none of the, you know, I was the only Jewish girl, one of the only Jewish girls in my school. So that, you know, nowadays I don't even think about that, but that, you know, kids will find anything to pick on you about.
Of course.
You know,
of course.
I found people who were like me, you know, like I said, single parents. We lived in apartments instead of houses. We had so much freedom. We did not need to be home by dark even. And it was, we were suffering from anorexia and bulimia as well. And we were, you know, we were, it was a camaraderie that we had all been through similar things.
Yeah. It was your pack.
Yeah, it was. It was. It wasn't a healthy pack, but it was needed at the time.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I'm getting to, this idea on the show that animals, I meant to say humans, but that was Freudian.
You're right. I'm not going to take offense to that, but thank you.
Humans are pack animals.
It's true.
Period. And one of the ways we inadvertently sentence each other to slow death is by kicking you out of the pack or making you feel like you don't belong, right? So everybody's Jewish but me, kicked out the pack.
Yeah.
Everybody has two parents but me, kicked out the pack. And we underappreciate how much our young people feel that and how poisonous it is. So you steal that pack of cigarettes out of the machine, you start smoking, you find your pack, which, okay, unhealthy pack, quote unquote, but wrap their arms around you.
Yeah. And I also left behind a lot of good friendships, too, that would have helped me through it had I let them. These were, we were all of the outcasts then. We were the nerdy ones. We were the, you know, skinny and, you know, underdeveloped prepubescent ones that were very smart and kind, all turned out to be, you know, PhD, whatever, whatever. And I just completely abandoned them for what I thought I needed so bad at the time. So there's a guilt around that as well.
Yeah. But you were so young. How could you know that? Because like part of what I think all of us can try to do differently for the generation after us is really emphasize the value of kind.
Yeah.
Right? Like we underappreciate it so much. And like you said, if I had been able to let those friends, they were kind. So if I had let them been able to be kind to me, maybe things would have turned out differently, but that's not on you. That's on all of the rest of the like wrapping around you that somehow made it uncomfortable for people to be kind to you.
You're hitting on, and I never thought of it back then, but hitting on stuff I'm still working in with therapy today, what my therapist calls the good milk. And I can't let the good milk in because I don't think I deserve it. And that's a total, I never thought of it that way to the other kids. And I think in a lot of ways, I felt unworthy of them and their kindness and that I was, you know, stupid. They were all very smart girls and I felt stupid because the learning disability and I didn't understand a lot of the, you know, a lot of mainstream teaching. Now I understand that. So, so yeah. The good milk is still hard for me to swallow.
Yeah. That was a lot for you to deal with when you're little. And it really goes to how we call those the formative years because they really do form how we perceive the world and how we interact with the world. Even now, I mean, I know you're only like still like 19 years old or whatever.
Excuse me, I'm 40. Don't let the pigtails fool you.
Hey, Claire, how's your mattress?
It's fine, I guess. Why? How's yours?
Better than fine, I'll tell you that much. You should look into Helix Sleep. At helixsleep.com/recovery, it takes just 2 minutes to be matched with the perfect mattress just for you.
Did you take the quiz?
You know I took the quiz. And I was matched with the Midnight model. As a side sleeper for life, it has been perfect for me. And They shipped it straight to my front door for free.
What? It also looks like they have those mattresses that always stay cool, which I've wanted to try because I am a very hot sleeper.
You and Joel. They even have a 10-year warranty and you get to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. There's a reason Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ and Wired magazine. Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/recovery. That's helixsleep.com/recovery for up to $200 off and two free pillows.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between. Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us. So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. So 13 years old, has been kicked off of so many islands, has a hard time. And I want to language, I want to change the way I just language that because I'm intentionally not making any of this your responsibility at the age of 13.
Okay.
So has had a devastating loss, divorce, has been kicked off of so many islands, has been made through whatever combination of experience, unable to accept the good milk.
Mm-hmm.
And you find yourself using meth.
Yeah.
At 13.
Yeah.
How do you get to rehab?
Okay, well, I have to say that meth, in the same way that I probably should have been on Ritalin or something, it brought me out of my shell in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It made me happy. I was definitely depressed at the time. I was doing some therapy and some medications, but it wasn't working. And I started using it pretty regularly for almost a year. And then I got caught at school with paraphernalia. So I didn't have drugs on me, thank God. I know it's from a privileged place, too, that the cop said to my mom, take her to rehab or she's going to juvie, which mm-hmm. I totally understand is not a regular occurrence in the big wide world. Off to rehab I went for my 14th birthday.
What was good about it and what would you have changed?
Great question. The other girls there and my roommate eating regularly.
A pack.
There you go. What a great connection. The group therapy was great. Looking back, it wasn't, you know, we didn't have great insurance. We had 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. It was insane.
That actually probably was great insurance, but don't get me started.
Ooh, wow. Oh my God.
Don't get me started. I feel it. I feel myself getting started. Go ahead, Georgia.
Oh, get started. I didn't even think of that.
It probably was great insurance to be able to get 2 weeks for an adolescent. But sorry, I didn't mean to digress you. Go ahead.
No, that's we need to know that. That's an amazing point. It was in Santa Ana, mm-hmm. which at the time, and it's probably still not, you know, not an affluent place. And so the girls I was in there with, the young women, the things they were going through really opened my eyes, you know, and I realized even at 13 how much privilege I had and what a luck, you know, they didn't have parents who cared, you know, they didn't have access to a great education, which I did if I wanted it. Mm-hmm. And it really opened my eyes. And I thought, who the fuck am I? You know, like, you are throwing away every advantage you have. And it's a slap in the face and it's not fair. And as I left that place, one of the young, who knows if she was a nurse or like training, she said, or just one of the wards said, you'll be back to me as I was leaving. And in my mind, I'm a fucking stubborn girl. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I won't. Mm-hmm. I didn't say it to her, but in my mind, I was like, bullshit. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to prove her wrong, which maybe that's why she did it. Because I still did meth after I left for a couple months. And eventually I was like, yeah, this isn't for me. I don't want to go back there. And I don't want her to be right. And I don't want to show my face there again and show that I can't take advantage. Mm-hmm. And I quit. Which now as an adult, I'm like, you quit meth.
That is
hard.
Next level. Hard is an understatement.
Yeah. When I'm like, I'm suck, I can't do it, I think back to that girl. You know, the chutzpah.
Yeah.
That she had. So,
yeah, for sure.
I was going to NA and AA meetings. Mm-hmm. So I had some good people in my life who wanted to help me. A pack! And, you know, a pack. And my mom started going to Tough Love.
Ooh.
You know that movement?
Ugh. I was about to say, it's tough.
Detrimental, I think.
Detrimentally tough, yeah.
Yeah. So there was some more, you know, supervision. And I like to read a lot. I always have. And so I just started staying home and reading.
And that was 27 years ago?
I'm 40. Sure. You do. I'm not good at math. Yeah. 27 years ago. And, you know, I still struggle with alcohol. I never really did drugs again. Luckily, in my 20s, when my friends were doing drugs, I was very aware what a close call I had. Mm-hmm. And so there was, but, you know, alcohol isn't a drug and it's fine and adults do it and it's social. So it's taken me to now and a long time of wanting to stop and working on stopping and whatever that meant to being on Anabuse now for the past month.
Oh, congratulations.
Only. Thank you.
Brand new.
Wow.
Yeah. This is, it's an awakening and I'm dealing with it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to.
Yeah. Have you heard of this movement called the Alt Recovery Movement?
A little bit, actually, not that much. I've been avoiding, honestly, like I've been avoiding the tough work because I don't want to admit it. And I don't want to get devoted to something because I like drinking and I want to drink. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely like, I'll go to AA again, or I'll go to Al-Anon again, knowing I should and knowing I don't freaking want to, you know? Okay. So tell me.
Yeah. Alt Recovery says, I kind of gave a little tagline at the beginning of the show, there are infinite number of paths to addiction. And so there are infinite number of paths to recovery.
And they don't tell you that.
No.
They.
And so even interestingly, what made me think of it just now is that your path to recovery for methamphetamine is even a separate path than your own path to recovery for alcohol. We do this to ourselves in a lot of ways in this culture, which is like all or nothing. Like either you're worthy or you're not.
Yeah.
Either you're smart or you're not.
Yeah.
Either you're pretty or you're not. Either you're in recovery or you're not.
Nuances in recovery. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah. Tell us, Georgia, then, you've already started to describe it a little bit, but like how the journey to recovery from methamphetamine eating disorder was different than this journey for alcohol.
I'm learning now a lot of it is kind of similar to the meth that I'm I'm putting up a wall between the feelings that I don't want to feel. Mm-hmm. Like the other day, I was sober and I had what felt like a manic episode. I think it was hormonal. And all I wanted to do was throw vodka on it. Mm-hmm. Like, I hate these feelings. I'm crying. I hate crying. Mm-hmm. It feels so vulnerable to me. And alcohol, it numbs the pain. It puts me in a better quote, headspace, mm-hmm. or out of it headspace. Mm-hmm. The next day, I'm hungover and I don't have to deal with it. I don't have to throw myself into life. I don't have to accomplish things. I can procrastinate, and there's a reason I'm doing it. It's acceptable. Mm-hmm. Like, I text friends, I can't come over and hang out. I can't go through with my plans. I'm hungover. And they're like, okay, yeah, girl, get something to eat, you know?
Right.
And I think at 13, I also was like, there's more to life than this. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, no, you're going to be drinking for the rest of your life. There's no quitting. There's no like, well, I hit 45, I'm going to quit. Mm-hmm. Everywhere I go, I'm like, you know, we're going out of town and I'm going to sit poolside. And the first thing I think is, ooh, I'm going to have a glass of champagne. We're going to get a little tipsy at dinner, red wine. And I like can't imagine ordering a Diet Coke mm-hmm. at a fancy dinner. It's just ingrained in me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You and so many others. And I think you said earlier, I'm taking Anabuse. Mm-hmm. Because I have to, even though I do not want to stop drinking.
Mm-hmm. Part of me doesn't want to stop drinking.
I think you do want to stop drinking.
Yeah.
But you don't want to start feeling.
No, it sucks.
And that's the trade-off, right?
You know, my therapist wants me to find my baseline. And I'm on antidepressants. I'm on anti-anxiety. I'm like, I fix so many parts of my life. I go to endocrinologist because I'm tired all the time. I have a CPAP because I'm exhausted all the time. Mm-hmm. I take vitamins. I do all these things. And I'm like, I said to her the first time I started seeing her, you know, I want to do ketamine because it helps with treatment-resistant depression. And she goes, you don't have treatment-resistant depression. Mm. And I'm like, well, I've taken all these meds. I've tried everything. And she's like, you're still drinking. Like, I'll do everything, mm-hmm. but quit drinking. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even cross my mind that that's the one thing, probably the worst thing for me and for my depression and my sleep. And I refuse to fucking let it happen until now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's suddenly hitting me.
Yeah.
How much I was not wanting to deal with it.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. We have to take a quick break, but I have a follow-up question for when we get back.
Welcome to the dough where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because y'all, season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
I guess, so I'm wondering, like, when you decided to stop using meth when you were younger, you were saying that, like, when you were taking it, you would start to feel happy. Mm-hmm. It was like changing a lot of the way that you were feeling then. Mm-hmm. So when you stopped and depression came back and all those things, what were some of the things that you did then to cope with those feelings?
Luckily, and I think it's partly being Jewish, therapy and meds are par for the course. So I know a lot. And, you know, Karen and I, Karen too, her mom was on podcast. Her mom was a psych nurse. Mm. So that we talk about it, therapy, all the time, because for both of us, it's the most normal conversation. It's like you meet someone, you're like, so what meds are you on? Because you seem really happy. It's like open. And we get so, we found that so many people, that's not, you know, we're from California. It's like the most normal thing. So I was lucky enough that, you know, when I needed to go to therapy, it was there for me. And getting on, you know, Prozac was just the baseline of it. So that was very, very fortunate in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and now, I mean, but now you're like, you're seeing a therapist now. You talk to her all the time.
I'm seeing a therapist twice a week, which at first I was like, I'm not that bad. No, I can't. That's like, that's for bad, bad people. And then I was like, you know, bad.
Yeah.
And now I realize that it was one of the things missing in my therapy, because you talk about your week and what's going on the first day on Monday. And then on Wednesday, how did you feel about what we
work?
And I freaking know how lucky and privileged I am.
I'm glad you're taking advantage of it, because there's something still super scary hanging over you. And that's why the idea of not drinking is like, how in the world? Like you said, when you were 13, you stopped meth and you were like, something better is out there for me. And so like, as a psychiatrist, what I hear when you say that, and then what you say now when you're like, I can't imagine not ever drinking. Think about the last month that you haven't been drinking.
Yeah.
You went into that month thinking, there's no way I could ever not drink. Like, how would I live my life?
Yeah.
And so how has it been? What's different about it than you thought it would be? What's the same about it that you thought it would be?
Okay. Well, it's as hard as I thought it would be. The anabuse, which for those who don't know, makes you, you can't drink.
Cannot.
It makes you sick. I've tested it once this month because that's how hard it is. Even though you know you're going to get sick, I turned bright freaking red. You just, it's a fucking compulsion. So I still want it. I still freaking want it. And I knew I would. It's definitely getting easier as the weeks go on, but it is hard. And I knew it would be. However, the mornings, you know, I'm able to get up with the puppy. I'm able to get up with my husband and have quality time together, time without my cell phone. It's a blessing. And I'm able to remember so much more. And it makes me realize I was pouring a thing on me that made me like senile almost. And it's a depressant. And you understand that definition so much more. You know, that word is bandied about in my life so much. It's a depressant. It's a depressant. And then it's like, you think about it squashing you and your personality and your light and your heart. It is literally depressing that. And that is ugly. And I can't believe that that has been something I've been choosing. I can believe it. It works. And I'm giving myself, my therapist and I talked about it, I'm giving myself 3 months. But then it's like, and then what? I'm not a person who can have 2 glasses of wine and be fine once a week or a couple times a week at dinner. I'm not.
I will bet that when it's the hardest, there's an underlying fear or sadness, whether you can put your finger on it or not.
Okay.
And so when you say in 3 months, then what? I think in 3 months, then what I would hope you'll be able to do, no matter. So, okay, you tried out drinking on antabuse. Don't do that again because you can die. Okay.
Oh, you can.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Death is literally part of the consent process for antabuse. Okay. Like, you can die.
Ooh.
Even if it was like the stock market fits and starts. That in general, I'm trending up and I accept that.
I love that.
Or even if you've struggled, say, I mean, you know, say your stock chart looks like the airlines after COVID came out and is just pointing straight down. You know what I mean? Damn, these last 3 months were effed up. But man, did I try.
Yeah.
And this is kind of, I'm going to use to like dovetail us into this idea of magic formula, which is like, for any illness, condition,
yeah,
lack of health.
Okay.
We say it develops for five reasons. Biological reason, coded in your DNA, but then also those adverse experiences that you had as a kid.
Yeah.
Change our DNA also, right? So biologically, yeah. You already told me you're on antidepressants, you're on anti-anxiety medications, you're on anabuse. Bam. Biological.
Yeah.
Psychological. It develops for a reason, right? Like, what were those life experiences that you had that isolated you, marginalized you, made you feel less than, made you unable to accept the good milk? You're in therapy twice a week, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Socially, stress is the number one thing that's going to knock any chronic illness off its rails.
Wow.
Alcohol use disorder included. So what's your formula around stress?
Don't read the comments.
I know that's right. Don't do it.
I'm trying to incorporate exercise too, light walking, yoga, things I enjoy. But that is not a mindset I'm in right now. And I'm accepting that.
Yeah.
But yeah, baths, reading, you know, watching fun TV, not just things I have to learn. Mm-hmm. We're watching The Sopranos right now, and it's like awesome. Also, I can eat as much See's candy as I want right now because I'm not pouring alcohol on top of it. So that's self-care to me.
Totally. That was better than expected for the last month. So the last two parts of the formula are cultural, political.
Okay.
So how are you defining yourself culturally, politically? How are you feeding that? How are you nurturing that?
I'm not. I'm just pure anger.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just avoidant as to the argument, but trying to help the defenses by donating money, by putting stuff on my Instagram to make people aware, to not shying away from my very, very open liberal views. And I don't care if we lose listeners because of that.
Hmm.
If I can do anything, it's help people with mental health and spread that the word of that life is not being evenly distributed to people. But it's anger. It's diffused a little, even though I know the world is shit and politics are horrible because Trump is out. And then I also, my mom voted for Trump and stood by him the whole time. And so I had a lot of anger towards her through that. But I feel like her power has been taken away a little bit, which is nice. So I can kind of talk to her again. I'm just angry. I'm just angry for everyone. No, that's not the solution, probably. So what do you mean? Like, what could I do to infuse goodness in there and feel like I'm contributing?
Yeah, that's the question. Because you're a contributor. Like, in life, you're a contributor, or it wouldn't be so important to you. You would just do a fun podcast, like The Sopranos.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's important to you to contribute to the well-being of others. And there are other people who are struggling just the same way you're struggling, where it just feels like pure anger.
Okay. And are there some tools I can use?
Yep. Talk to your therapist. She's got all the tools. I'm not being cute. I'm being serious.
I literally, in an hour, have an appointment with her. So this is like so perfect. I told her I was coming on and she was like, that's amazing. I love it.
So you have so many parts of your magic formula. Like, you're killing it right now. I'm super, super proud of you.
Thank you.
I'm not super proud of you because you're not drinking, but I'm super proud of you because it takes a lot to come in public and be like, I'm struggling with drinking and I haven't had a drink for a month and it hasn't been amazing. Like, everybody's like, recovery, it's amazing. It saved my life.
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting so much done. I've lost weight.
Exactly.
I haven't lost a freaking pound. See's candy, I blame you.
Right? So I love, love, love this real perspective and that you brought your whole self to us today. But you have to bring your whole self to yourself, okay? Including the anger.
You've given me a new focus. I mean, I could I could cry if all my medications didn't block that too, but this is like the most rewarding Zoom I've ever had in my life.
You're a mitzvah.
You're a mitzvah.
No, you.
Oh my God. Thank you.
Georgia, thank you for coming on.
What a beautiful thing you guys are doing. I'm in awe. I'm in awe. You're doing such an incredible thing for people.
I'm so glad you came on.
Likewise. Likewise.
Thank you.
Me too. Well, that was a delightful interview with Georgia. You know, I got the book that she and Karen wrote or co-wrote together. It's called Stay Sexy and Don't Get Murdered, sort of as I was like getting ready for this interview. And I started listening to a couple chapters and I ended up like binge listening to the whole book. It's really good. Yeah. Very insightful. Very good. Very funny.
I have to get it, especially since I plan on staying sexy and not getting murdered. Like, yes. These are two life goals. Yeah. So,
yeah, two things I would really like for the rest of my life. I do have one really quick question just to follow up on hers about anger and like what to do with that feeling of anger. Because I think that even just like with the pandemic, just like this feeling of frustration and not necessarily having access to like normal coping mechanisms or like, I don't know. I feel like there's like a lot of things that anyone could be angry about at any given time in the world right now. So if there's not access to therapy, what are some alternatives for either feeling really angry in the moment or just like having a lot of old anger or current anger? Like, what are some things you can do with that?
Really, the first thing is like even recognizing what anger feels like for you. And so we get trained out of anger very, very young in this country. And so a lot of times we don't even recognize what it is. And so anger a lot of times can be very physical, like you feel hot or you feel tense or you feel your heart racing or you feel your jaw clenching or you feel yourself breathing fast, right? Like anger and anxiety can actually feel very similar.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times we will think anger is something else.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
So one, recognize it. Two, accept it. We're taught how unacceptable anger is, that we become experts in immediately discounting it, explaining it away, turning it into something else, right? So you're angry and you're like, no, I shouldn't be like that. And you turn it into guilty.
Yeah.
Or you're angry and you're like, oh, that person didn't mean that. And so then you turn it into understanding. Mm. This is important. Like, we'll get to that for sure. But we have to be able to accept anger and then decide how we're going to react to it. So first, recognize it. Second, accept it. I'm trying to come up with like a third one that I could just make this an easy word for y'all, but I don't necessarily have an easy word for it. So I say manage it. M.
Ram.
You like this?
I think that's perfect for anger.
Okay. The third one is manage it. The way to manage it, I know you're going to be like, I know this woman did not just tell me to count to 10. These are grounding exercises. It is like getting some space to let the physical reaction come down. Because what happens when we're having that emotional physical reaction, you know, I always talk about the two parts of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, which is the thinking brain, the deep brain, which has your amygdala. That's where your emotions are. When your emotions flare in anger, that's your fight or flight system. And your fight or flight system shuts down your thinking system because it needs you to react quickly without thinking about it. And we want to do the exact opposite. So the mindfulness approach to this, recognize it, accept it. Like, you know what? I'm angry and I accept that I'm angry. And then we do our grounding. Take a deep breath. Count to 10. There's this 5-4-3-2-1 strategy, which is like, what are five things I see around me? Like just five random objects. Mm. Point out five objects. What are four things I can touch? Just touch four things and say it to yourself. These are all just grounding, right? What are three things I hear right now? This is bringing yourself back into this moment. What are two things I smell? So these are your five senses, right? See it, touch it, hear it, smell it. What's one thing I taste right now? And then you do kind of that sensory grounding that gives your thinking brain a chance to say, this is what I'm angry about. And this is how I want to respond.
I like that.
This is our anger ram. Recognize it, accept it, and then mindfully manage it. That's the In Recovery anger management course for today. And George is going to be like, for real? You waited until I hung up to share these
and she's pearls? Like, okay, thanks for that. So if you want to find Georgia or her podcast, it's called My Favorite Murder. Her book is Stay Sexy and Don't Get Murdered.
Two very appropriate life goals.
Yeah. And we are so excited that season two is here.
I know. It seems like forever since we ended season one. If you like what you heard today, you should definitely check out season one. We talk about how everyone is actually addicted to something. And the definition of addicted that we use is that you keep doing it, even though the negative consequences have started to outweigh the positive benefits. So whether that's methamphetamine or technology, screen time, or reading negative comments about yourselves on your social media, if you continue to do it, even though it's causing negative consequences, that was our definition of addiction. So we had episodes about all kinds of stuff. I would say probably Claire, my favorite episode from season one was the Addicted to Racism episode.
Yep. I loved that one.
One, content, obviously topic, like racism and, you know, undermining racism and equity is like one of my passions, but I really loved the response that we got to that episode because thinking of racism as an addiction was like a new way to think about it for people, but continue to do it. Negative consequences fits, right?
Yep.
I also have to say, though, I know you told me choose one favorite episode, but you know, classic Nzinga fashion. I loved all the Ask Me Anything episodes where it was like whatever question came in, we just gave answers to it. And then there was one we did. You'll have to tell me the title of it, Claire, but it was a wife who called in worried about her husband's gambling. And she was like, is it just me or is it really a problem? And I thought that was really what a lot of people experience when you know in your gut that there's something to be concerned about here, but it's such a difficult topic to bring up that you're trying to talk yourself out of it. Like, is this real or is this just me?
Yeah, the Am I Overreacting episode, which is like what so many questions that we get seem to say, like some version of is this real? Am I overreacting? Am I making this up? So yeah, I loved that episode. I think some of my favorite was probably, I loved the one with Evan about how to not do addiction alone.
Yes.
I really also liked the one about weed being addictive because we just talked a lot about like stigma and misinformation, but then also the one about like the intersection of addiction and ADHD, just exploring topics that on a surface level, you feel like you know a lot about because you hear so many of the same narratives and then talking to you about them and hearing stories from guests about them. It's like, it has changed so much of the way that I think about addiction. So if this is your first time listening, I it's easy for us to say because we are obviously hosts of the show, but I highly suggest going back and listening to season one and listening to some of the episodes.
if we say so ourselves, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of a recap of season one. And as we mentioned in the beginning of this episode, for season two, we're really trying to widen our focus to be more inclusive of the mental health and recovery that all of us need to do in response to the experiences of the last year.
Right. And that's why we are so excited for next week's guest, Claire Bidwell Smith. She is a grief counselor and talks to people for a living about how to handle the loss that they are going through. So make sure you tune in. And thanks so much for listening to our very first episode of season two. We'll catch you all next week.
Bye.
Bye.
In Recovery is a Lemonada Media original. The show is produced by Claire Jones and edited by Ivan Kurev.
Jackie Danziger is our supervising producer. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad with additional music by Ivan Kurev. Stephanie Whittles-Wax and Jessica Cordova Kramer are our executive producers. Rate us, review us, and say nice things. Follow us at Lemonada Media across all social platforms, or find me on Twitter at N.A. Harrison MD. If you've learned from us, share the show with your others. Let's help destigmatize addiction together.
Lemonada. Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.